From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Welcome to The Media Project, WAMC's weekly program that attempts to shed a little insight into how and why the media does what it does. Rex Smith is off this week. I'm Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association. Welcome. We have with us today a fine panel, beginning with Alan Chartok. He is the CEO and Grand Poobah here at WAMC. Welcome, Alan.
Poobah, indeed.
And longtime Media Project listeners are going to love this. Rosemary Armeo is back.
Yay!
She's the investigative and reporter and editor in the Middle East, and she's returned to us for a
holiday visit. Yeah.
Great to have you back. And we also have with us today Kaylin Brown, the chair of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose in Albany.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, hello. So let's start with what we've all been talking about this week, and that is the president's Oval Office address. In retrospect, was that a good idea to do? And how did the media do in terms of fact-checking this throughout the process? Who wants to start?
Rosemary will start.
I'll start. Okay. I think we had no choice. We had to do it. It was his first Oval Office address. He is, despite our horrors over it, the president of the United States, and he deserved that. The next time he asks for time to address the nation, I think it ought to be addressed with a lot more skepticism. He presented nothing new. It was filled with errors, and it's time to acknowledge that this is a president different than other presidents, and the media needs to respond in different ways.
But you, Rosemary, just for the heck of it, you made a point yesterday about Netanyahu and giving a similar speech and what happened to him.
That's a very good point. And again, the Israeli media may be pointing a way for us to look at. In the Netanyahu had promised a dramatic address, and he got on the air. He's accused multiple charges of corruption, and he began doing what Trump did, giving his usual stump speech and exonerating himself. And the networks cut out and went back to regular programming.
So, Rosemary, do you think that his address was intended to distract the public from other issues?
I think this president enjoys being the center of attention, and he found another new way to be the center of attention in the middle of a lot of news about other places and people. And he didn't put a lot of work into it. There was no new research or numbers in it. There was not a single new point that, at least at any commentator, I certainly couldn't hear anything new in it. So I don't know if it's distraction. Is he just trying to distract from Mueller, which is getting harder and harder to do? Or does he just like being the person everyone's listening to?
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. The guy has told some journalists that he didn't want to do this, that his staff made him do it. And so the one thing that this guy is better at than anybody I've ever seen, he's an obfuscator. So in other words, he'll say one thing, then somebody in his own administration will say the exact opposite. And we've had to live with all of that. Foreign policy is a great example. When you take Syria and the reporters, of course, this is the Media Project, the reporters all comment on how ridiculous his position is. He didn't check with anybody, anything else. And then you get guys like Mike Pompeo, Lindsey Graham, his longtime follower in the Senate, and they say the exact opposite. And we all just lift our shoulders and say, huh?
Well, the primary question about this Oval Office address, I think, had to do with, from a media perspective, whether or not the media should cover it. And we have had many questions about that since this presidency. Should every utterance of this particular president be covered? That's a real question. Right. I do think it puts reporters in a very tough position because you don't want to miss what a president is saying, no matter the president. It's important to be paying attention. I understand why the viewing, listening, watching public would be very concerned about him using the Oval Office as just a political platform for him to espouse his views on what the Republican Party thinks rather than what's best for the nation.
But you know, Professor, What? Why are you looking at me that way?
Because you're a professor.
Well,
I was.
I'm washed up.
So, you're all media lead.
No, but you know that the number of people watching this address was a historic high.
How did the numbers look for Stormy Daniels folding her underwear to a couple of?
I considered watching that instead. That was interesting.
I don't even know
about that. She was wearing a lovely lavender brassiere. it was on until almost 9 last night.
Really?
Oh, yeah, with music and everything. And it's totally media worthy. She was using all forms of media to make it happen. It's a Media Project extravaganza.
But where was it? I mean,
she had tweeted out prior to the announcement. Oh, I knew this would capture his attention.
We can get back to the media elite issue. Because,
Judy, just
Stormy Daniels tweeted out, don't listen to him. Yeah. Watch me fold my laundry and my underwear instead.
I get it.
Oh, and she did.
Uh-huh.
To music.
A few minutes ago, Alan referenced a private off-the-record session the president had with the network anchors before the speech. How appropriate do you think that was? Do you think network anchors should be sitting down with the president and agreeing to talk to him extensively off the record in advance of a speech?
Well, they immediately went out and talked about it later, so I'm cool with that.
but we have discussed at great length on this program this whole trap of off-the-record.
Yeah.
But who is it a trap for? Generally, reporters do not offer off the record. It is usually a source who is asking for off the record to share information. It's not to the reporter's advantage.
But, Jalen, this is a president of the United States. The president of the United States is making this offer, not somebody that you know, I know that you talk to your students and you do it so well, and you tell them, right, these are the rules for off the record. But this is the president of the United States, and you know that the others are going to accept it. You have to sit down with him.
I would do it. I would do it because it's so hard to get information about this guy beyond his tweets. And he changes the information. He changes his mind at any minute. So I would totally do off the record. And then I would rely on him to do what he has done frequently, which is to break the rules. He did it with the New York Times. He does it consistently. He goes, this is off the record. And then he goes and tweets or talks about it, which leaves you free to give the whole story. And I would totally do it.
It should be noted that within 24 hours, President Trump was tweeting, criticizing the press for leaking that information that
Correct.
He gave in that off-the-record luncheon.
Correct.
And again, talking about the media being totally bonkers.
I think the fact that the media did leak it is acceptable because I agree with you, Alan. It is the president. And if he does something newsworthy, even in an off-the-record reference, it is newsworthy and the obligation is to the audience. But I just think it's something to be careful about because the public has lost so much trust and faith already in the media that to have the president then accuse the media of violating its own rules is problematic and could cause more trust issues.
Well, you know, you make such a good point. We know that this president has violated every norm that anybody has ever heard about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here we have this other norm, which is off the record, on the record. And we have the potential for a president leading this country into a totalitarian state. At what point do you break the rules? I mean, what point you're a reporter, do you break the rules?
I think the reporters have been breaking the rules throughout this presidency because they've had no choice. I mean, think about Jim Acosta jumping up and continuing to bark questions because he's compelled to do that. It's, I have to do my job, even though this barrier is in my way.
I would like to see the press really take a look at the rules and break them in a bigger, more dramatic way. Jim Acosta jumped up. Why are we in that press room? It's a steady stream of lies the same way that his speech was. So why are we there all the time? That White House can be covered without going to Sarah Huckabee's show. There are other things. Jen from the Berkshire Eagle talks about this on the roundtable quite frequently, and I've come to think that she is very correct. Rules about on and off the record need to be looked at. Rules on pronouncements of the president need to be looked at when you have a guy who's tweeting sometimes 18 tweets in a morning. And tweets are not widely read in this country by the viewing public, but they are widely read by journalists. And we are giving him a wider audience. Is that what we really ought and should be doing?
No,
Rosemary, I agree. We should not. I think we have a real problem with deciding what deserves our attention and what we should just know. Yeah. He's used his Twitter feed, and that's sufficient. We don't need to acknowledge everything in a news story.
We have a governor in New York State who is a master at taking what I would only call an immunity bath. Because when you walk in the room and he invites you down there, he says, let's keep this off the record. He's invited you down there and said, let's keep this off the record. Well, you know, he's going to say some extraordinary things to you, and you wonder, why am I even here if we have to keep it off the record?
You know, this whole idea of rethinking how we cover the president and dispensing with some of the norms, this whole notion of false equivalency, the Associated Press ran into a little bit of buzzsaw shortly after the speech when it posted this tweet, AP fact check, Democrats put the blame for the shutdown on Trump, but it takes two to tangle. Trump's demand for $5.7 billion for his border wall is one reason for the budget impasse. Democrats' refusal to approve the money is another.
Oh, my goodness.
So that prompted an almost immediate reaction on Twitter, where within hours, the tweet had racked up about 20,000 replies against a much smaller number of retweets and likes. Among Twitter users, that's known as a ratio, and it's not a good sign. It means that readers are on the attack. So this idea that for every pro, there has to be a con is something that, you know, the traditional news media has really struggled to do. But now we're thinking, do we do that all the time? And AP seemed to be overreaching on this in this case.
Yeah. AP definitely tries to be very, very balanced and equivalent on both sides. And, yeah, you get a ridiculous statement like that as a result.
Mm-hmm. And we've always said, Rosemary, what's the other side on the Holocaust?
Yeah,
I mean, you
exactly.
know, I mean, these things, are, as Judy just said, are false equivalencies so often.
Well, here's the thing. I think the press totally is under attack by the current White House. So what do we gain by sticking with the old rules? We have his total contempt and he is on the attack. If we change the rules and publicize why and how we're changing the rules, he'll be upset and he'll tweet. We're exactly where we are. There's nothing to lose by trying to do it differently. And I say that knowing and seeing how during the election this happened, that we have added and given validity to the impression of conservatives and Republicans that the press is anti-Trump and anti-them.
Well, of course, as we have said so many times on this program, the press is held in low repute by the public. We're not exactly sure why. I've always had a thesis that, you know, somebody, because I always talk about this, Rex gets very mad at me, so I'll do it without his being here, going to a service club and talking, and why is Mario Cuomo so mad at the press all the time? I said, if you've had a story written about you, hold up your hand, and they all hold up your hand. Put them down if the story was correct. No hands going down. So the perception, even though, Kaylin, you're looking at me as if I'm a bum, the perception is, whether it's correct or not, that the press gets it wrong.
I agree that that's the perception, but the follow-up question is the key. When those people did not put their hands down, did any of them contact the news organization they claimed wronged them? Because if you are really wronged, generally you would contact or make an effort to fix the problem.
Nah,
people complain that they've been misquoted all the time. Point to me where the misquote was.
Nah. You know, you're all nodding your head in your sagacious ways.
Because we've all had the experience.
Yeah. No, I get it. So a magazine came out this weekend and they had called me up and asked me about Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and they wanted my things and where were the best restaurants in Great Barrington. And I named one restaurant and I said, it's the best sandwich I've ever had. And they don't serve sandwiches, and I damn well knew it. And I was talking about another restaurant because we were going down a list. I didn't call a guy up and say, you got it wrong. This'll do right now, right here.
Switching to another subject, we got a letter from a listener, Phyllis from Rhinebeck. She said, good morning, panel. On Sunday, January 6th, the Poughkeepsie Journal announced the traditional editorial page is gone, in part to accommodate more local, regional, and state news. She says the Journal is replacing regular editorials and letters with community discussion through our Facebook page. At present, the Journal provides most of its news through the USA Today network and Associated Press. Truly local news appears in obituaries and advertisements for local business.
Oh, teacher, can I go first?
And you certainly can.
Okay,
sir.
Let me just say that the Poughkeepsie Journal was a great newspaper by every comparative standard. Every year, the Times Union with more resources and the Poughkeepsie Journal would compete for who was getting the most awards in New York State. They did extremely well. They had a great editor, Stu Shinsky, who is a fabulous person and a fabulous editor. And for some reason, the parent company decided we're basically going to close her up. Now, they publish USA Today, right, and all these other things. But now it's a shell of itself. And here's a reader who writes in and is absolutely right. There's not even a separate editorial page.
And how important are editorial pages, though?
They're very important. And once again, I'll go back to Kovac and Rosenstiel's Elements of Journalism, which says that journalism has an obligation to provide a forum for the public to be heard. And that forum is generally letters to the editor. I know there's been a digital shift, and the digital shift now warrants online space for comments, which is valuable. The expectation is that print copies will soon be gone. There will be no more hard copy newspapers. That's probably going to happen at some point, maybe not in my lifetime. So perhaps this is forward thinking. I'm guessing the cost of newsprint is so exorbitant that this is a way to save money and to still get local content in. Is more local news more important than reader comments in the paper? That is a very important question.
Well, what hits me about this is the deception. It's the same lies that newspapers told all through the 90s when they were cutting staff and space, saying, we're going to do more with less. It's going to be make no difference here. It was all a lie. It was all to cut costs. And it did make the papers worse and less valuable, even to the people who supported them. And this is one more example. If there is a digital switch and you're not getting as many letters, fine. You're not using as much space then. You provide both the written letters that are vetted and checked and all that we go through, and you provide maybe a look at the digital page. You don't take away one and then tell readers this is for your own good. It's awful, and we're not fooling any of our customers with this.
And let's face it, it's all about money, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, you're listening to The Media Project on WAMC. If you have a comment you'd like to send us, you can reach out to us by email at media@wamc.org. Another issue, this is whether or not the media is to blame in some respects for mass shootings because we identify the shooter or we give the shooter extensive publicity. Should the media really rethink this and take better care not to publicize the identities and the backgrounds of the shooters?
Oh, wow. This was the piece of reading we did in preparation for this broadcast that disturbed me the most. Basically, a lot of scholarly research indicates that there is real damage done by extensive coverage of mass slayings because of the copycat effect. Young would-be killers say, oh, I want to be famous like this too. Look at all these pages. Look at that picture of that guy in the paper. And they've put together quite a bit of information indicating that that may be the case. It reminds me very much of suicide. Newspapers have never been allowed to really cover suicide as the community horrors that they are because of the copycat effect. And I always made fun of that idea, saying it's ridiculous. You don't hide the idea of a suicide, because if it happens in a school, everyone in the school already knows it. The newspaper is just simply making an issue. And name for me one social ill that was ever cured by ignoring it. We didn't talk about slavery. Did that take care of the problem? We didn't talk about incest. Did that take care of the problem? We didn't talk about rape for the sake of the victims. Did that take care of rape? No. And yet this one bothers me a lot because the evidence is there. And because of this thing, I don't care if we use his name. The research says don't use their image and their name. Okay, great. Give me all the background. Tell me all about them. I don't think people remember names anyway. So I could do this. I could live with this. And journalists do have an obligation, as the researchers point out, to tell the truth, but to do it with minimizing harm done. So, okay, don't use their names. I don't need to know the Roof's name. I just need to know all the information about him, how he got to that point.
Not only that, there's always the euphemisms. There's the hints that the newspaper will give you. You read an obituary, and they say, died at home. Now, there are plenty of people who die at home who did not commit suicide. But it's gotten to be sort of an understanding on a lot of people's parts that if they died at home, they committed suicide.
That is not the fact. I don't think most people leap to that conclusion.
Oh, I know a lot who do.
Your point is right, though. Died of a long illness that for years was cancer.
Right.
Because for some reason, it predates me, but cancer was a negative thing. You didn't want to admit you have it. So in the obituaries, it would say died of a long illness. That was cancer.
On the question of using the names of shooters and their images, I would have to say that once, because we have an obligation to share that information, but then not again. Then go and use all the background. I think we have an obligation to identify, but not to keep repeating. The problem with this, and the story that we read for today, didn't make reference so much to the same issues happened way back in the 90s with Columbine. And I vividly remember the New York Times writing an entire story back in the 90s, the late 90s, about the copycat syndrome and how should the media deal with this. But it seems that the media keeps raising the question but is not coming up with a solution. Do we go through our lifetimes and never find solutions to the problems we want to find? That's the bigger question. You're Why am I here, Judy?
You know, I do think the media is being unfairly criticized for not focusing on the victims enough, because as a practical matter, in the first 24 to 48 hours, we don't know who the victims are most often, because you have next of kin being identified. Right. And so you have this time period where there's a vacuum, and the vacuum gets filled by our quest to figure out who did this and why. 2 or 3 days later, when things have settled down, if it's not a huge mass killing, then interest in the victims is going to subside just from a news value.
There also is true value in researching and writing about the perpetrators. You discover patterns. We still don't know what motivated the guy in Las Vegas, for example. And reporters provide incredible instant history by going out and doing that research.
Great
I
point.
Don't want that lost.
Great point. In fact, Rosemary, there's a whole push now. It's almost pablum. It's all a mental health problem. It's all a mental health problem.
Yeah.
How do you know it's a mental health problem unless the reporter's telling you something about it?
And often reporters are the ones finding out this information before law enforcement, because often, especially in mass shootings, they'll deploy multiple resources to various places, and the investigative techniques are strong.
And there's one other thing, too. I don't like the media getting blamed. We get blamed for everything. But in this case, when guns and inadequate mental health screening and treatment are much more the causes of these mass killings in the United States than media coverage, come on.
Yeah, bravo, Rosemary. That's exactly the case. Nobody is talking about that as much as they are at this point. But there is clear research that shows that some of these mass shooters are looking for publicity. But again, the issue of mental health and gun control gets discussed a lot, but not in this case.
Correct.
And when it gets discussed by the media. The media is bringing up the mental health issues and finding out the records and the documentation to support what happened with this perpetrator.
And there's one other thing, too. If you read it closely, I did. This really disturbed me, this article. It is something journalists should think about. The numbers are weird. Rampage killings. Only 30% of them in the world happen in the U.S. Does that feel right to you? I didn't have time to go back and look at the original research, but that does not feel right.
There have been some big ones in other countries, it's true. And another thing to note on this one is the impact of social media, because there's mainstream media, and we certainly can decide only to use the name once or to use limited amount of details about the person, the shooter, but there's a whole new world out there in social media, and who will know who did this, and that will fan the
Good
flames
point.
Of publicity and celebrity for the shooter as well. And that isn't anything we really can control, or as a freedom of speech issue, maybe we even want to control.
That's a really good point.
But, you know, it keeps coming down, as far as I'm concerned, it keeps coming down to the integrity of our reporters, who have to know all about what to do in terms of balance, have to be sensitive, but still have to do their jobs. Rosemary, one of the things I admired about you very much is you were on the scent of a very interesting story here in New York State with a man named Elaine Calieros. And you went to visit him. He's now convicted and probably on his way to jail. He's been sentenced. You went to visit him. And at a time when everybody thought this guy was untouchable because of how tough he was. So, I mean, I keep thinking about you. You had the instinct. You went. You did the interview. It was very interesting.
Yeah, it didn't do much good. But, yeah, journalists who track this, the studies all concentrated on someone who took a real hard investigative look at Dylann Roof. I need to go back and read that piece. And tracked, was looking for just what we talked about, the patterns, the little hints that something's going wrong, so that you will eventually figure out some way to deal with these issues rather than just cover them after they happen, which seems to be what we do most of the time.
But it is easy as a journalist to get discouraged.
Very.
Oh, yeah.
When you write about something and nothing really happens. That happens at the state government level a lot. It happens in cases like the ones you cover, Rosemary.
Yep.
But it does happen, Judy. When you think about it, it happens more than a lot of people want to think, in which police departments say, well, we decided we're going to go back and take another look at that after the articles in the paper.
Exactly.
Which is why journalists need to keep going and keep researching and keep producing stories that shed light.
Well, we've done it again. We've wrapped up another media project. Thank you all for listening. I'm Judy Patrick. I'm here with Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, and Kaylin Brown. See us soon.
Soon.
We'll be back probably with Rex.
Tingling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.